Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. This is Peter Bregan. Glad to be with you. There's lots of really good things going on out there in the world. And my guest, in fact, has some responsibility for a lot of those good things. And she's a dear friend. But before getting to her, I want to just comment on the changing environment that's going on. And today I had lunch with a professor from Cornell in a wholly different field. And he was talking about history and how bizarre it will seem to future historians that we are putting so many of our citizens on psychiatric drugs. He said that people will look back on my work and say, basically, you know, why did he even have to do all that work? Wasn't it obvious to them? Well, I don't know what history is going to say, but the definitely outside of psychiatry and medicine itself, that clique and the AMA and the APA and NIH and all those folks, there's a real big change is going on, which, again, we'll talk about with my guest today. And I wanted to reference an article that came out earlier in September, but I didn't get to talk to you about, which indicates the amount of change that's taking place. And it was in the New York Times, of all places. I mean, they've been nothing more over the years, but you know, just a henchman for anything in psychiatry, from psychoanalysis decades ago to lobotomy to shock treatment and, of course, the antidepressants. But here's an article that came out entitled Possible Risks of SSRI Antidepressants to Newborns. And they talked about the large percentage of the pregnant women, up to 14%, who are taking antidepressants, and that the Food and Drug Administration has issued strong warnings about the birth defects, which, by the way, my wife and I wrote a scientific article in the Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine, more than a year ago, about these dangers. And here we have somebody out of Canada, the British Columbia School of Population, pointing out that while the claim is that these drugs are helping depressed women and that that's better, more important than the risk of the birth defects their children are having, and this associate professor, hope she has tenure, said if the antidepressants made such a big difference and women on them were eating better, sleeping better, and taking better care of themselves, then one would expect to see better birth outcomes among the women who took medication than among similar women who did not. And she says, what's striking is there's no research evidence showing that. Now, just first, there's the truth of this. That's important. But second, the idea that the New York Times would say this. Now, we shouldn't have a psychiatrist quoting, you know, here, but she, you know, the article does have this professor. And it also quotes Dr. Adam Urato, U-R-A-T-O. Dr. Urato's been on our show talking about these issues long before they reached the New York Times. He's a maternal fetal medicine specialist at Tufts Medical School, heart of the establishment, but again, not psychiatry. And he points out that serotonin is a critical neurotransmitter and cell signaling molecule. He's discussing during fetal development. From the brain, it signals the neurons where to go, what to do, and how to develop. It signals the heart. It plays an active role in the gut, and it plays an important role in the formation of the lungs. What it does during development is basically everything. And he's talking about fetal development. It does everything. Well, you know, it's also the most widespread, not the largest necessarily, but the most widespread neurotransmitter in the brain. And serotonin exists also in the gut and in the blood. And, you know, whoever thought messing with it was going to be good for anybody? The they're finding lots of problems with giving these drugs. Everything from ADHD in the kids who've been exposed to really severe problems with heart defects and even microcephaly, which is small head, which means shrunken brain, and it's just a disaster. So that for my introduction to what I call ginger snaps, because usually, hopefully, Ginger passes these by me as I get ready to come on the show. My guest today, Gina, are you there?
I am here, Peter. How are you?
Good. Well, you're loud and clear.
Good.
Good. Yeah. Yeah, things are good here. Ginger and I send our love to you and your husband, Bob. Gina Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L, N-I-K-K-E-L. She's been on the show before. She's the executive director of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. The Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. This is the only foundation, maybe Gina could correct me, but I think it's the only foundation that actually supports the whole spectrum of innovative work in psychiatry, on both the establishment side, which we forgive her for, and on the really great and creative side. Our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy is affiliated with Gina's organization. Gina is also an assistant clinical professor in psychiatry at the Oregon Health and Sciences University, which tells you she's in Oregon. She's done a lot of work in community mental health programs and brings a lot of experience, both organizational, but also what she calls learning from the people with the lived experience. And I'm going to just unleash Gina to tell you about some of the work that she is helping to fund through her organization, the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care, which will actually at the same time tell you about what's going on in the frontiers of mental health. Hi, Gina. You're unleashed.
Hi. Well, thank you, Peter. And hello to everyone out there. Well, you know, the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care started 3 years ago, and the reason that it started is because several of us around the world, got together and were really taking a look at some of the statistics. And one would think, with the advent of new treatments and new medicines, et cetera, that in the last 30 years, you would think that outcomes would have gotten better, not worse. And we are particularly interested in the statistics that in the United States alone, 1,100 people a day are being put on the disability rolls for being diagnosed with a mental illness. And that made some of us wonder. And as I know, certainly as I spend a lot of time with people with lived experience, more and more questions came up, and we decided that we needed to start having some dialogue about that. And also, in the last several years, the advent of more and more research has come about, really shining the light on the concerns about medications, particularly in the treatment of I call them mental health challenges. I don't call them mental illnesses, because I think that at any time, any of us can have a mental health challenge. And certainly, people do have mental health challenges that may be biologically based, but I think that for the majority is not the case. So we began to ask a lot of questions. And we founded this foundation and have been looking at a number of practices and also research components around the world. And it's really exciting because As we go down the road, Peter, we really are finding out from many research components out there that antipsychotics and antidepressants are not what we once thought they were in the field. And as you well know, they're becoming more and more dangerous. And I think that's a discussion that we around the world need to have, and have a good open dialogue about what is and what isn't. As you know, Peter, there have been several researchers, you know, to name a few, Courtney Harding in the 80s, now Martin Harrow, you know, Wondery, Gleason. There's several researchers that are starting to shed light of the problems that we're having with medications treating mental health challenges. So that's what we're really taking a look at. Let me talk just about a few things that we're doing now that I think will be of interest to listeners. We have been working with Krista McKinnon, and Krista is just a fabulous facilitator. And what we've done is we've come up with a class, online class, called Recovering Our Families. There's two classes, Recovering Our Families and Recovering Our Hope. And those, we've been getting great feedback on there. So you can get to those online classes by going to familieshealingtogether.com, familieshealingtogether.com. And they really are a support and a lifeline for families and loved ones, helping their loved one that's a person with lived experience to get through what they're dealing with. And I think it's a great resource. You told me that you were going to unleash me, so I'm just unleashing.
Go. I really want you to talk about your programs.
Excellent. The other thing we're doing is we have a funder that has been generous in helping us take a look at a model from Finland, Western Lapland, called Open Dialogue. And we thought, you know, the research is phenomenal. The outcomes are phenomenal from that model, and we wondered if it could be replicated in the United States with the same fidelity. So we are working with University of Massachusetts in adapting the Open Dialogue model to the United States, and we have a funder that's been generously giving us a grant to help them do that. And so we're creating a fidelity scale and also a clinical manual, because that's what insurance companies have to pay for this. And it's preliminary, but it's looking like it's working very, very well so far. And what this model does is basically delays medications for the first several weeks and wraps services around the person to make sure that they have everything that they need. And what we find out is about 75 to 80% of those people never need to go on medications at all, which we think is a real coup in this day and age. As you know, the United States and New Zealand are the only two countries that have direct-to-consumer marketing, and we think that's a real problem as it tends to sell medications as the next magic bullet. And we all know that medications are not the magic bullet. While some people feel that they're a help to them, we know a lot of people that in fact they create more problems for. So we want to continue those dialogues.
The figure you gave, that 70% never need meds, is that out of Lapland, Finland, or is that out of programs you're beginning to fund?
That's out of programs that we're beginning to fund and take a look at. And of course,
that is marvelous. Can you address those programs a little more?
Sure, absolutely. So one of the things that we're doing, some of them are programs, some of them are research. We've been working with Dr. Martin Harrell out of the University of Chicago, Illinois Med School. He has been doing research for over 30 years with people diagnosed with schizophrenia. And then the name of his research project is, Does Long-Term Treatment of Schizophrenia with Antipsychotic Medications Facilitate Recovery? You can just imagine, Peter, what he is finding out with this 30 years worth of data. What he's finding out, of course, is the people over a two-year period. So if you're on medications for over a two-year period, your outcomes are actually worse. So it's about the same for the first 2 years on medication, but after that, recovery goes down drastically if you're on medications. People do better if they're not on medications, which we think is significant and that the world needs to know about. He will continue to do research on this for the next 2 years, and we think that that is will have some really significant data points for us over the next 2 years.
Gina, it'll be interesting. I should have been reading this stuff, and I haven't been looking at his latest work. But it's going to be interesting to look at because I don't believe the outcomes can possibly be equal in those 2 years because the people on the psych drugs are going to be developing tardive dyskinesia, horrible movement disorders. Some of them are going to be developing life-threatening cardiac problems and neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Some of them are going to be getting metabolic syndrome with obesity and high blood pressure and diabetes and so on. So I think that you can't be looking at that enough if the outcomes are coming out the same at 2 years. They got to be worse.
Well, I would agree with you, Peter. However, I am not the expert on the
data. Wanted to make a note for the audience, and I'm going to take a look at that, at his work more. I haven't looked at it in a while, and come back and let folks know what I find looking at it. He's able to continue his work in part because of your Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care?
Absolutely. We felt that the work he has done in the last 2 years has been so stunning that he wanted him to continue. And again, we're interested in what the real answers are, particularly about medication, because there's been so many issues, as you know, with use of medications to treat not only schizophrenia but other diagnoses. And again, it goes back to we really feel that there needs to be a lot more research and people that are not tied to a particular industry coming out and talking about what's really going on with the treatment of mental health challenges. So that is one of the issues that we are funding. We've also are deeply, deeply concerned about the overprescribing of psychotropic medications to children. So we also have a project at UMass, and Massachusetts General Hospital, looking at evaluating the proposed national quality standards for children. Right now, the quality standards for children, we believe, does not articulate well enough what the lower levels of medications should be. We think it's way too high with the research that we're seeing. And so we're very, very interested in teaching prescribers how to step down that standard of care when they're taking a look at children and not prescribe so many medications, because we think the over-prescribing of psychotropic medications to children will have grave consequences in the future and are having grave consequences now as we speak. All the literature that we've seen addresses that. So,
Gina, how are you able to do a project like that with, I think you said, the Mass General, that's Harvard, when they've got their child psychopharmacology branch with Biederman, who is taking the drug company money, and he's promoting bipolar disorder, and he's been he's been under heavy attack, and Harvard hasn't done a thing to him for his taking secret monies to promote drugs for kids, taking monies right from the drug companies, from Johnson & Johnson. How does that work, that you're able to have a project like that going on there? Have you any idea? Or is that something you wouldn't know?
That's interesting that you bring that up, and that's one of the reasons when we were approached by two doctors from Massachusetts General Hospital, saying that not everybody is in agreement in that particular facility, and they're really interested in taking a look, particularly about the psychotropic medications. We wanted to jump on that because we think that the theories about psychotropic medications for children, in particularly, that not everybody at that establishment agrees. So we wanted to explore that, and we were able to get a project there. So we think any time that you can get other data into the mainstream, that it's the best. And, of course, we don't want skewed data. What we want is unbiased data, that research is able to be taken a look at through an unbiased lens, meaning that nobody has stock in the outcome of the research, if that makes sense. Nobody will profit by the outcome of this research.
Well, in fact, this particular research, people are going to get hammered for doing it. I think it's just marvelous. You know, folks, listen to this. This is one cutting edge after another project being funded by this group. And there really isn't anybody like you, Gina, as far as I know. And again, we're talking to Gina Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L, from the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. It's just remarkable, the three you've described so far, trying to develop the Finnish programs in this country, the funding Harrow's research on the long-term outcomes from schizophrenia, and this work, new work that I've never heard about before. We're working with the Mass General on looking at the standards for giving psych drugs to children. It's just astonishing what you're doing. What kind of support are you getting, and what kind of flack are you getting, just for a few minutes before we go to break in about 4 minutes?
Sure. Well, Peter, I want to talk a little bit about us as a community foundation. This is really designed to be all of our community foundation. It's not funded by one particular family or not one particular entity or agency. It's the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care really is a mechanism for all of us to get together and pool our money so we can support a specific research events or programs. And several people have stepped up to the plate, several wealthy individuals, as well as people that have given $10 or $50 or $100, because everybody's money together pays for this research. And we are really blessed to have some people that see the need for this foundation and have stepped up with quite a bit of money. to help start the foundation and continue the foundation.
Yeah.
And after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about how funds are started and other projects.
I started the show out talking about, you know, that times are changing, and they really are. We can't expect psychiatry to change on its own. People are going to simply have to start refusing their services. They're not going to change. They're wedded to the, in my opinion, obviously not speaking for Gina, psychiatry is wedded to the drug and diagnosis model. It's where their income is, their authority, their power. But people around the edges are really beginning to change, and the public view is changing. And I just think that it's just remarkable what you are doing. I want to take a minute or two and do something that's separate from you and me, Gina. I want to remind people that another group that's doing great stuff is PRN, the station you're listening to. It's a nonprofit station. Gary Null started it. It has people from across the political spectrum speaking what they believe to be true without fear of retaliation. This station, in some ways, like Gina's organization, is an opportunity to get around the vested interests that control, in this case, not science, but that control the media and discussion. And for the first time in its history, PRN is reaching out. And by the way, I was not asked to do this. I am doing I have recorded a little something for the station to use, but I just wanted to add my words here that anything you can do to support PRN is going to go well. And you can get, you just go to the PRN website and there's a button you can press and you can learn a ton about it. But I'm grateful right at this moment to Gina Nickel and her foundation, and then grateful to PRN for being a place where we can talk about these issues. So, you know, help out, folks. These are groups that need your support and need your help. And we can go to break now. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and I am speaking over the wonderful music of Vangelis. And my guest is Gina Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L. Easy to find her with her very interesting name on the internet, executive director of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care, and a friend. I thought it might be nice for Gina to speak a little more about something she started to talk about earlier, and then she's got more projects to tell you about, and that's about the online projects offering mental health kinds of services, support services online. Could you pick up a little more on that, please?
Sure, Peter. Yes, I think we started talking about the Families Healing Together project. It's online, an online class that you can take. And it's really great. Familieshealingtogether.com. You can go to the classes and take them. And they really cover a number of subjects.
Are they free, Gina?
That particular program is not. There is a cost to it. I know that you know, some people go on and pay the cost. Others sometimes will get sponsors to pay the cost for that. We have to pay the facilitator, and so we try to keep the prices as low as possible, but there is a cost.
And they can see those prices up front if they go?
Absolutely.
I bet it's cheaper than psychotherapy.
Much. Much cheaper.
Good, good.
Than
okay, continue.
But basically, what those courses cover is exploring recovery fundamentals, you know, understanding mental health, harnessing the power of hope, using a strength-based approach, and building relationship amidst, you know, psychosis. It's funny sometimes when people are in the stage of psychosis or having issues, you know, they automatically think that they have to go out and go through steps 1, 2, or 3 with their medical doctor, and that's not necessarily what needs to happen. And so this really goes over creating healthy boundaries, you know, celebrating recovery stories. I've taken the class myself because I wanted to make sure if it was of quality and of a caliber that we wanted to have represented us, and it's really a phenomenal one. It's really good. Another project that I'm really excited about, Peter, is that we have a fund within the foundation, and anyone can open a fund. It has to fit within our mission. And, of course, our mission is to match the power of private philanthropy with the world's best researchers and programs for recovery-based care. Another person opened a fund with us. A lot of people will recognize his name, Robert Whitaker. And this is the Mad in America Continuing Education Program. And what this program will be is an online program with some phenomenal speakers and components talking about what medications do to your body, a really up-and-front discussion about what works and what doesn't and what actually happens. Will have some of the top psychiatrists and researchers in the world talking about the issues with medications. I think it will be really great, not only for doctors to take. There'll be continuing medication or medical education credits. There will be credits for social workers, and of course, that doesn't prohibit the average person from taking these courses either. And they are very, very cost-effective courses. Look for those on our website, mentalhealthexcellence.org. I think that those will be really great. Another fund that we have that I've had the privilege to sit through and really listen is the Hearing Voices Research Fund. And so there in the UK, there's the United Kingdom, there's a Hearing Voices Network, and it's really made up of people, voice hearers, that help people get through their voice hearing and learn how to manage their voices in a completely different way than is usual and customary in the United States. And we are in the process of supporting those groups in the United States. And usually non-voice hearers don't participate, but I was invited to a class, and I was absolutely fascinated and honored with the breadth of knowledge, compassion, and expertise that facilitators ran these groups. These are all people that hear voices and have learned to manage their voices and their psychosis using natural and supportive means without the use of forced anything. Let me put it that way. So that's really incredible. Another thing we have coming up is we expect it out later this month, is we have a fund called the Healing Voices Film Fund, and my good friends, they've become good friends because they've opened a fund and I've gotten to know them, but P.J. Moynihan and Oryx Cohen have helped make a fund called Healing Voices, and it's all about the power of listening and being with each other in a mental health crisis. So those are just some of the few of the things that we're doing. And I'd be remiss if I didn't tell the listeners out there, please come to our website, mentalhealthexcellence.org, because new things are going up all the time and what we're doing, and we certainly would you know, pay attention to if anybody wrote us an email. But I did want to point out that we have one of our major funders thought it would be good if they gave us a challenge grant. So we are the proud recipients of a challenge grant, and I would challenge each of you out there to go to our website. There's a donate button. But if we raise $250,000 by December 30th of this year, at the end of this year, then this funder will give us another $250,000, which basically means we turn $250,000 into $500,000. And so we're very pleased to be the recipients of that challenge grant. And I really believe that we learn the most from people with lived experience. Again, those of us that have been public policy people, like you, Peter, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, in the field. I don't know about you, Peter, but where I got my most experience from, and I think the best teaching, was not in college, but was when I started practice and really listening to people with lived experience. That has helped inform how we run the foundation. And we have a lot of people on our advisory committees and on our scientific advisory committee that have lived experience, and we're learning a lot. We also have a number of other funds. So people will open funds. We have a risk.org fund. So risk.org, you can look them up. But the risk fund, basically what it does is helps people to record what their drug side effects are if they've taken it. As you well know, drug side effects are now a leading cause of death and disability and illness. And we believe that everybody's experience ought to be recorded, whether it's reported by a doctor or not. We have provided, and risk.org has provided, a way so people can catalog their experiences so other people can learn about it, and it may help them. So I think that that's very, very important. I'll stop for a couple minutes, Peter, so you can break in since this is your show.
Well, you know, the motto here is that I want to bring out the best in my guest, which is not hard. I just sit and listen when you're talking. A couple of thoughts. I wanted to clarify for people and see if I'm correct in describing how you work as a community fund. If somebody has a legitimate program that they want to develop, and let's say they've gotten to, they think they can get some money together, but they don't have the wherewithal to go through the IRS process, which I've done on two occasions, to set up your own nonprofit organization. Well, you can get in touch with the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care and propose to them that you go under their umbrella as a nonprofit through them to conduct your work. and to get your funds so that if then you find somebody who wants to fund you, they can get their tax deduction by giving it to you. Am I correct in what I just said?
Absolutely, Peter. The way we work is we have donor-advised funds, and we also have what you just described as incubator funds. That's somebody with a great idea that wants to attract other funding, but really doesn't want to go through the process of setting up their 501c3 just yet, and they need a little bit of help with that. So that's one of the services that we certainly do provide, and I'd be glad to talk to anybody about that. We have several incubator funds within us and several donor-advised funds. And again, what the foundation really supplies is that funding network. We connect people, so we're really the connectors. We connect great programs, great researchers with philanthropers to get the job done. And so we're the infrastructure to do that, and you described it very well. So again, we know that there needs to be a private philanthropy component if we are ever to change the way that mental health services are delivered. We believe that there needs to be a new standard of care, a recovery model, if you will, a wellness health model instead of a disease model, particularly when it comes to mental health care.
Now, are you like a lot of other funds out there, like NAMI and CHAD and all those AstroTurf bipolar organizations secretly taking pharmaceutical funding?
You know, that is the one thing we absolutely will not do. We do not take pharmaceutical money. And the reason that we don't is that we don't want to be beholden to any one group, whether it's pharmaceutical money or AstroTurf money or anything. We believe that the research that we help conduct, we believe that the programs we support should be done so with non-biased money, meaning people don't have won't benefit by the outcome. Certainly we want people with lived experience to benefit by the research we're funding and the programs, but we want to make sure unequivocally that there is not a stake in the outcomes. And so we really feel that it is not in our best interest as human beings for pharmaceutical monies to pay for any of these research and programs.
You mentioned earlier that you are working with the Voice Hearers. I first met them a couple of decades ago on a trip to London or maybe Sweden or Norway, but up around that area. And I think they're so important because it's really clear that a lot of people hear voices.
Yes.
And some folks even see things and they function in this world and they have good lives. Some of them are friendly with their voices. Some of them see them as projections of their own minds. Some of them feel that they believe they're coming from outside them. And people, I mean, it's like the whole fabric of psychiatry is built on, if you have an experience that doesn't fit with what we consider normal, you're sick, which I think is a sick view in itself. And I'm really glad to hear that you're supporting them. Is it at the stage yet where somebody could go online who hears voices and, like one of my clients, say one of my patients, could go online and connect to useful information now, or is that in the offing?
Yes, that is in the near offing. In fact, one of the things that we have paid to do is to help create a website for voice hearers, and we're in the process of doing that right now. So again, we are in the process of creating support for voice hearers. It's just you know, literally not very far away.
I think a lot of very creative people have experiences that people who pride themselves in being normal aren't having, but also aren't being as creative. And certainly when you read the lives of people who have been poets and novelists and, you know, other kinds of creative artists, the boundary between real and unreal that we want to force on ourselves in the medical model, it just doesn't quite fit. It's not what life is really all about. And I just think that's so important for people to realize. And it's been very hard for me to face that and look at that. But the human mind receives all kinds of inspiration and information from itself and maybe from elsewhere. And I think rather than giving destructive labels to the experiences people have, it's so much better to, when people want, to work with them on how to either make the most of those experiences or to manage them better. And that's certainly, I think, the voice hearer's approach. And I really praise that. I really like that.
Well, you know, another good example, Peter, is another fund that we have that is great, that I think every human being on this earth should take. And it's a fund, it's called Emotional CPR Fund. So, you know, when someone has a heart attack or has heart problems or something, you know, a lot of caregivers learn CPR, right, to help start somebody's heart, et cetera. And we have a fund advisor who thought, well, what if we created an emotional CPR class to teach people how to listen to somebody that is in emotional distress? And it's called Emotional CPR. And I've sat through some of those classes, and I really believe every college student, it ought to be taught in high school. It ought to be taught in every business. And that's an example of another fund we have.
And that's up and running?
That is up and running. You can go on our website right now, mentalhealthexcellence.org. Click on the donate button, and it will give you a menu of what you can donate to if you want to give specifically to something, and it's all right there.
It's so important. Again, in contrast to the medical model and psychiatric practice in particular, many, many people who, if they went to a psychiatrist, would end up drugged and in a mental hospital and in a career of being a mental patient, with one good conversation with another human being could begin a recovery process and not go down that road at all. And one of the nicest things that we hear are the, you know, we get phone calls and we get messages from people that, and I probably never even said this on the air before, that, you know, that our work has saved somebody's life, changed somebody's life, changed the life of a loved one. There's just a breath of fresh air in from a book, from a website, from a human being, can change the entire trajectory of someone's life, especially when they are at the what they feel to be the end of their road. And in psychiatry, if you're perceived to be at the end of your road, it will get cemented into place. As surely as people, the mob used to, maybe they still do, bury people under cement. If you go into traditional psychiatry today, in a crisis, it will be turned into cement. whereas so often crises can be handled with kind words and thoughtfulness and an offer of a safe place for a while and other outreach. And I think in this case, even though it's a medical metaphor, I think the CPR metaphor is really a good one, because people who have a heart stoppage can be revived by CPR, and it isn't always a chronic condition.
That is true, Peter. And again, I think underscoring the listening skills is so important. You know, we were talking about statistics, et cetera, and I just turned to one here that I have for the open dialogue model of listening. And again, you can go on our website to give to further this research and this program too, because we really want this available in every community in the United States. This research that they've done on the open dialogue model, 67% of the participants in this model forego antipsychotics without relapse at the five-year marker. That's amazing. 67% of participants forego antipsychotics without relapse at the five-year marker.
Now, where on your website does somebody just go and find that? Under what subject or?
So if you go on to our website, you can click on the donate button and it will come down, and Adapting Open Dialogue to the United States will be under the Bill Anthony Research Fund. If you don't want to donate, or you're thinking about it and you want to look for more information, you can click under funds on our website and go to the Bill Anthony Research Fund, and in the drop-down menu, there'll be more information.
And folks, you can click on that fund button and you'll find the Fund for Empathic Therapy. Guess who that is? That's us.
Absolutely.
And we're just very, Ginger and I are really, really happy to be a part of what you're doing, and to be friends. It's just really, really glad. We're talking with Gina Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L, Executive Director of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. And also, by the way, Assistant Clinical Professor in Psychiatry at Oregon Health and Sciences University. We have maybe a minute left. Say a few last words. I just want to say, hey, thank you for everything you're doing. You are so incredibly important in the future of our society, our culture. The work you're doing is just wonderful. Your closing thoughts.
Peter, my closing thoughts are that we all need to listen to each other, and we need to hold hands together, because it's going to take all of us to change this paradigm. And it's really about the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care is about all of us joining together and to do what's right and to listen to each other.
I'm really, 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 really glad to have you on. And we'll just stay in touch and have you back again and again over the years.
Thanks,
thank you,
Peter.
Gina Nickel.
Hugs to Ginger.